The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, Section 2, continued. Cassette 4, Side 1.
France herself would not fight, but as her commission for organizing the deal, would take the Ukraine right bank as her share. England wouldn't fight either, of course, but in order to raise a scare, promised to send her fleet into the Black Sea and into the Baltic. In return, she would get Caucasian oil. The actual warriors would, for the most part, be the following. 100,000 émigrés. True, they had long since scattered to the four winds, but it would take only a whistle to gather them all together again immediately. Poland, for which she would get half the Ukraine. Romania, whose brilliant successes in World War I were famous. She was a formidable enemy. And then there were Latvia and Estonia. These two small countries would willingly drop all the concerns of their young governments and rush forth en masse to do battle. And the most frightening thing of all was the direction of the main blow. How's that? Was it already known? Yes. It would begin from Bessarabia, and from there, keeping to the right bank of the Dnieper, it would move straight on Moscow. Who drew that arrow for Krylenko on a cigarette pack? Was it not drawn by the same hand that thought up our entire defense strategy in 1941? And at that fateful moment, would not all our railroads certainly be blown up? No, not at all. Bottlenecks would be created. And the Brum Party would also yank out the fuses in electric power stations, and the entire Soviet Union would be plunged into darkness, and all our machinery would come to a halt, including the textile machinery. And sabotage would be carried out. Attention, defendants, you must not name your methods of sabotage, nor the factories which were your objectives, nor the geographic sites involved, until the closed session. And you must not name names, whether foreign or our own. Combine all this with the fatal blow which will have been dealt the textile industry by that time. Add the fact that the saboteurs will have constructed two or three textile factories in Byelorussia, which will serve as a base of operations for the interventionists. This was not intended as a joke. With the textile factories already in their hands, the interventionists would march implacably on Moscow. But here was the cleverest part of the whole plot. Though they didn't succeed in doing so, they had wanted to drain the Kuban marshes and the Polisai swamps and the swamp near Lake Ilmen. Vyshinsky had forbidden them to name the exact places, but one of the witnesses blurted them out. And then the interventionists would open up the shortest routes and would get to Moscow without wetting their feet or their horses' hoofs. And why was it so hard for the Tatars? Why was it that Napoleon didn't reach Moscow? Yes, it was because of the Polisai and the Ilmen swamps. And once those swamps were drained, the capital would lie exposed. On top of that, don't forget to add that hangars had been built there under the guise of sawmills, places not to be named, so that the planes of the interventionists would not get wet in the rain and could be taxied into them. And housing for the interventionists had also been built. Do not name the places. And where had all the homeless occupation armies been quartered in previous wars? The defendants had received all the directives on these matters from the mysterious foreign gentlemen, K and R. It is strictly forbidden to name their names or to name the countries they come from. And most recently they had even begun the preparation of treasonable actions by individual units of the Red Army. Do not name the branches of the service, nor the units, nor the names of any persons involved. True, they hadn't done any of this, but they had also intended, though they hadn't done that either, to organize within some central army institution a cell of financiers and former officers of the White Armies. Ah, the White Army. Write it down. Start making arrests. And cells of anti-Soviet students. Students, write it down. Start making arrests. Incidentally, don't push things too far. We wouldn't want the workers to get despondent and begin to feel that everything is falling apart, that the Soviet government has been caught napping. And so they also threw a good deal of light on that side of it, that they had intended to do a lot and had accomplished very little, that not one industry had suffered serious losses. But why didn't the intervention take place anyway? For various complex reasons. Either because Poincaré hadn't been elected in France, or else because our émigré industrialists decided that their former enterprises had not yet been sufficiently restored by the Bolsheviks. Let the Bolsheviks do more. And then, too, they couldn't seem to come to terms with Poland and Romania. So, all right, there hadn't been any intervention, but there was at least a prom party. Do you hear the tramp of marching feet? Do you hear the murmur of the working masses? Death, death, death. And the marches were those who in the event of war would have to atone with their deaths and deprivations and sufferings for the work of these men. And it was as if he had looked into a crystal ball. It was indeed with their deaths and deprivations and sufferings that those trusting demonstrators would atone in 1941 for the work of these men. But where is your finger pointing, prosecutor? At whom is your finger pointing? So then, why was it the industrial party? Why a party and not an engineering technical center? We are accustomed to having a center. Yes, there was a center too, but they had decided to reorganize themselves into a party. It was more respectable. That way it would be easier to fight over cabinet posts in the future government. It would mobilize the engineering technical masses for the struggle for power. And whom would they be struggling against? Other parties, of course, against the Working Peasants' Party, the TKP, in the first place, for after all they had 200,000 members, against the Menshevik Party in the second place. And as for a centre, those three parties together were to have constituted a united centre, but the GPU had destroyed them. And it's a good thing they destroyed us. All the dependents were glad. And it was flattering to Stalin to annihilate three more parties. Would there have been any glory indeed in merely adding another three centers to his list? And having a party instead of a center meant having another central committee. Yes, the prom party's own central committee. True, there had not been any party conferences, nor had there been any elections, not even one. Whoever wanted to be on the central committee just joined up. Five people, all told. They all made way for one another, and they all yielded the post of chairman to one another, too. There were no meetings, either of the central committee. No one else would remember this, but Ramzin would remember it very well indeed, and he would name names. Or of the groups from various branches of industry. There seemed even to be some dearth of members. As Charnovsky said, there never was any formal organization of a prom party. And how many members had there been? Larichev. A count of members would have been difficult. The exact composition was unknown. And how had they carried out their wrecking? How had directives been communicated? Well, it was just a matter of whoever met whomever in some particular institution. Directives were passed on orally. From then on, everyone would carry out his own wrecking on his own conscience. Well, now, Ramzin confidently named 2,000 members. And whenever he named two, they arrested five. According to the documents in the trial, there were altogether 30,000 to 40,000 engineers throughout the USSR. That meant they would arrest every seventh one and terrify the other six. And what about contacts with the Working Peasants' Party? Well, they might meet in the State Planning Commission or else in the Supreme Council of the Economy and plan systematic acts against village communists. Where have we seen all this before? Aha! In Aida. They are seeing Radames off on his campaign, and the orchestra is thundering, and eight warriors are standing there in helmets and with spears, and 2,000 more are painted on the backdrop. That's your prom party. But that's all right. It works. The show goes on. Today it is quite impossible to believe just how threatening and serious it all looked at the time. And it is hammered in by repetition, and every individual episode is gone over several times. And because of this, the awful visions multiply. And in addition, so that things won't become too bland, the defendants suddenly forget something terribly unimportant, or else they try to renounce testimony, and right then and there, they pin them down with cross-questioning. And it all winds up being as lively as the Moscow Art Theatre. But Krylenko pressed too hard. On the one hand, he planned to disembowel the prom party, to disclose its social basis. That was a question of class, and his analysis couldn't go wrong. But Krylenko abandoned the Stanislavski method, didn't assign the roles, relied on improvisation. He let everyone tell his own story of his own life and what his relationship to the revolution had been and how he was led to participate in wrecking. And in one fell swoop, that thoughtless insertion, that human picture, spoiled all five acts. The first thing that we learn, to our astonishment, is that all eight of these big shots of the bourgeois intelligentsia came from poor families. The son of a peasant, one of the many children of a clerk, the son of an artisan, the son of a rural schoolteacher, the son of a peddler. At school, they were all impoverished and earned the money for their education themselves, from the ages of 12, 13, and 14. Some gave lessons, and some worked on locomotives. And here was what was monstrous. No one barred their way to an education. They all completed the courses in high school and in higher technological institutions, and they became important and famous professors. How could that have been? They always told us that under Tsarism only the children of landowners and capitalists. Those calendars certainly couldn't have been lying. And here and now, in the Soviet period, engineers were in a very difficult position. It was almost impossible for them to provide their children with a higher education. After all, the children of the intelligentsia had the lowest priority, remember? The court didn't argue, nor did Krylenko. And the defendants themselves hastened to qualify what they had said, asserting that, against the background of the general and overall victories, this, of course, was unimportant. Here we begin to distinguish bit by bit among the defendants, who up to this point had talked very much like one another. Their age differential also divided them with respect to probity. Those close to 60 and older made statements that aroused a friendly, sympathetic reaction. But 43-year-old Ramzin and Larichev and 39-year-old Ochkin, the same one who had denounced Glavtop, the main fuels committee, in 1921, were glib and shameless. And all the major testimony about the prom party and intervention comes from them. Ramzin was the kind of person, as a result of his early and extraordinary successes, who was shunned by the entire engineering profession, and he endured it. At the trial, he caught Krylenko's hints on the wing and volunteered precise statements. All the charges were founded on Ramzin's recollections. He possessed such self-control and force that he might very well have conducted plenipotentiary talks in Paris about intervention, on assignment from the GPU, obviously. Ochkin, too, was a fast climber. At 29, he had already possessed the unlimited trust of the Council of Labour and Defence and the Council of People's Commissars. One couldn't say the same about 62-year-old Professor Charnovsky. Anonymous students had persecuted him in the wall newspapers. After 23 years of lecturing, he had been summoned to a general students' meeting to give an account of his work. He hadn't gone. And in 1921, Professor Kalinikov had headed an open struggle against the Soviet government, specifically a professor's strike. What it amounted to was this. Back in the days of the Stolypin repression, the Moscow Higher Technical School had won academic autonomy, including the right to fill important posts, elect a rector, etc. In 1921, the professors in this school had re-elected Kalinikov to a new term as rector, but the People's Commissariat didn't want him there and had designated its own candidate. However, the professors went on strike and were supported by the students. At that time, there were no truly proletarian students, and Kalinikov was rector for a whole year despite the wishes of the Soviet government. It was only in 1922 that they had wrung the neck of that autonomy, and even then, in all probability, not without arrests. Fedotov was 66 years old, and he had been a factory engineer 11 years longer than the whole lifespan of the Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party, from which the Soviet Communist Party had sprung. He had worked at all the spinning mills and textile factories in Russia. How hateful such people are, and how desirable it is to get rid of them as quickly as possible. In 1905, he had left his position as the director of the Morozov textile firm and the high salary which went with it, because he preferred to attend the red funerals which followed the caskets of the workers killed by the Cossacks. And now he was ill, had poor eyesight, and was too weak to leave home at night, even to go to the theatre. And such people organized intervention and economic ruin? Tsarnovsky had not had any free evenings for many years because he had been so busy with his teaching and with developing new sciences, such as the science of the organization of production and the scientific principles of rationalization. I recall from my own childhood the engineering professors of those years, and that's exactly what they were like. Their evenings were given up to their students at all levels, and they didn't get home to their families until 11 p.m. After all, at the beginning of the 5-year plan, there were only 30,000 of them for the whole country. They were all strained to the breaking point. And it was these people who were supposed to have contrived a crisis, to have spied in exchange for handouts. Ramsin uttered just one honest phrase during the whole trial. The path of wrecking is alien to the inner structure of engineering. Throughout the trial, Krylenko forced the defendants to concede apologetically that they were scarcely conversant with or were illiterate in politics. After all, politics is much more difficult and much loftier than some kind of metallurgy or turbine design. In politics, your head won't help you, nor will your education. Come on, answer me. What was your attitude toward the October Revolution when it happened? Skeptical. In other words, immediately hostile. Why? 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 Krylenko hounded them with his theoretical questions, and as a result of simple human slips of the tongue inconsistent with their assigned roles, the nucleus of the truth is disclosed to us as to what really had taken place and from what the entire bubble had been blown. What the engineers had first seen in the October coup d'etat was ruin. And for 3 years there had truly been ruin and nothing else. Beyond that, they had seen the loss of even the most elementary freedoms, and these freedoms never returned. How then could engineers not have wanted a democratic republic? How could engineers accept the dictatorship of the workers, the dictatorship of their subordinates in industry, so little skilled or trained and comprehending neither the physical nor the economic laws of production, but now occupying the top positions from which they supervised the engineers? Why shouldn't the engineers have considered it more natural for the structure of society to be headed by those who could intelligently direct its activity? And, excepting only the question of the moral leadership of society, is not this precisely where all social cybernetics is leading today? Is it not true that professional politicians are boils on the neck of society that prevent it from turning its head and moving its arms? And why shouldn't engineers have political views? After all, politics is not even a science, but is an empirical area not susceptible to description by any mathematical apparatus. Furthermore, it is an area subject to human egotism and blind passion. Even in the trial, Tsarnovsky speaks out, "Politics must, nonetheless, be guided to some degree by the findings of technology." The wild pressures of war communism could only sicken the engineers. An engineer cannot participate in irrationality, and until 1920 the majority of them did nothing, even though they were barbarically impoverished. When NEP, the new economic policy, got underway, the engineers willingly went back to work. They accepted NEP as an indication that the government had come to its senses. But alas, conditions were not what they had been. The engineers were looked on as a socially suspicious element, that did not even have the right to provide an education for its own children. Engineers were paid immeasurably low salaries in proportion to their contribution to production. But while their superiors demanded successes in production from them and discipline, they were deprived of the authority to impose this discipline. Any worker could not only refuse to carry out the instructions of an engineer, but could insult and even strike him and go unpunished. And as a representative of the ruling class, the worker was always right in such a case. Krylenko objects. Do you remember the Oldenburger trial? In other words, how we, so to speak, defended him. Fedotov. Yes, he had to lose his life in order to attract some attention to the predicament of the engineer. Krylenko, disappointed. Well, that was not how the matter was put. Fedotov. He died, and he was not the only one to die. He died voluntarily, and many others were killed. Krylenko was silent. That meant it was true. Leaf through the Oldenburger trial again and just imagine the persecution. And with the additional final line, many others were killed. So it was that the engineer was to blame for everything, even when he had done nothing wrong. But if he actually had made a real mistake, and after all he was a human being, he would be torn to pieces unless his colleagues could manage to cover things up. For would they value honesty? So the engineers then were forced at times to lie to the party leadership. To restore their authority and prestige, the engineers really had to unite among themselves and help each other out. They were all in danger, but they didn't need any kind of conference, any membership cards to achieve such unity. Like every kind of mutual understanding between intelligent and clear-thinking people, it was attained by a few quiet, even accidental words. No kind of voting was called for. Only narrow minds need resolutions and the party stick. And this was something Stalin could never understand, nor could the interrogators, nor their whole crowd. They had never had any experience of human relationships of that kind. They had never seen anything like that in party history. In any case, that sort of unity had long existed among Russian engineers in their big, illiterate nation of petty tyrants. It had already been tested for several decades. But now a new government had discovered it and become alarmed. Then came 1927, and the rationality of the NEP period went up in smoke, and it turned out that the entire NEP was merely a cynical deceit. Extravagantly unrealistic projections of a super-industrial forward leap had been announced. Impossible plans and tasks had been assigned. In those conditions, what was there for the collective engineering intelligence to do? The engineering leadership of the State Planning Commission and the Supreme Council of the Economy. To submit to insanity. To stay on the sidelines. It would have cost them nothing. One can write any figures one pleases on a piece of paper, but our comrades, our colleagues in actual production, will not be able to fulfill these assignments. And that meant it was necessary to try to introduce some moderation into these plans, to bring them under the control of reason, to eliminate entirely the most outrageous assignments. To create, so to speak, their own State Planning Commission of Engineers in order to correct the stupidities of the leaders. And the most amusing thing was that this was in their interests, the interests of the leaders, too. And in the interests of all industry and of all the people, since ruinous decisions could be avoided and squandered, scattered millions could be picked up from the ground. To defend quality, the heart of technology, amid the general uproar about quantity, planning, and over-planning, and to indoctrinate students with this spirit. That's what it was, the thin, delicate fabric of the truth. That is what it really was. But to utter such thoughts aloud in 1930 meant being shot, and yet it was still too little and too invisible to arouse the wrath of the mob. It was therefore necessary to reprocess the silent and redeeming collusion of the engineers into crude wrecking and intervention. Thus, in the picture they substituted, we nonetheless caught a fleshless and fruitless vision of the truth. The work of the stage director began to fall apart. Fedotov had already blurted out something about sleepless nights during the 8 months of his imprisonment, and about some important official of the GPU who had recently shaken his hand. So there must have been a deal. You play your roles and the GPU will carry out its promises. And even the witnesses, though their role was incomparably less important, began to get confused. Krylenko, did you participate in this group? Witness Kirpotenko. Two or three times when questions of intervention were being considered. And that was just what was needed. Krylenko, encouragingly. Go on. Kirpotenko. A pause. Other than that, nothing is known. Krylenko urges him on, tries to give him his cue again. Kirpotenko, stupidly. Other than intervention, nothing is known to me. Then, when there was an actual confrontation with Kuprianov, the facts no longer jibed. Trilenko got angry and he shouted at the inept prisoners, "Then you just have to fix things so you come up with the same answers." And in the recess, behind the scenes, everything was once more brought up to snuff. All the defendants were once again nervously awaiting their cues, and Krylenko prompted all eight of them at once. The emigre industrialists had published an article abroad to the effect that they had held no talks at all with Ramzin and Larichev, and knew nothing whatever about any prom party, and that the testimony of the witnesses had in all likelihood been forced from them by torture. Well, what are you going to say to that? Good Lord, how outraged the defendants were. They clamored for the floor without waiting their turns. What had become of that weary calm with which they had humiliated themselves and their colleagues for 7 days? Boiling indignation at those emigres burst from them. They demanded permission to send a written declaration to the newspapers in defense of GPU methods. Now, wasn't that an embellishment? Wasn't that a jewel? And Ramzin declared, "Our presence here is sufficient proof that we were not subjected to tortures and torments." And what, pray tell, would be the use of tortures that made it impossible for the defendants to appear in court? And Fedotov, "Imprisonment did me good, and not only me. I even feel better in prison than in freedom." And Otchkin, "Me too. I feel better too." It was out of sheer generosity that Krylenko and Vyshinsky declined their offer of a collective declaration. They certainly would have written one, and they certainly would have signed it. But maybe someone had some lingering suspicions still. Well, in that case, Comrade Krylenko vouchsafed them a flash of his brilliant logic. "If we should admit even for 1 second that these people were telling untruths, then why were they arrested, and why did they all at once start babbling their heads off?" Now that is the power of logic for you. For 1,000 years, prosecutors and accusers had never even imagined that the fact of arrest might in itself be a proof of guilt. If the defendants were innocent, then why had they been arrested? And once they had been arrested, that meant they were guilty. And indeed, why had they started babbling away? The question of torture we discard, but let us put the question psychologically. Why did they confess? And I ask you, what else could they have done? Well, how true, how psychological. If you ever served time in that institution, just recollect, what else was there to do? Ivanov Razumnik wrote that in 1938 he was imprisoned in the same cell in the Butyrki as Krylenko, and that Krylenko's place in the cell was under the board bunks. I can picture that vividly, since I have crawled there myself. The bunks were so low that the only way one could crawl along the dirty asphalt floor was flat on one's stomach, but newcomers could never adapt and would try to crawl on all fours. They would manage to get their heads under, but their rear ends would be left sticking out, and it is my opinion that the Supreme Prosecutor had a particularly difficult time adapting, and I imagine that his rear end, not yet grown thin, used to stick out there for the greater glory of Soviet justice. Sinful person that I am, I visualize with malice that rear end sticking out there, and through the whole long description of these trials, it somehow gives me solace. "Yes," the prosecutor expounded, continuing along the same line, "if all this about tortures was true, then it was impossible to understand what could have induced all the defendants to confess unanimously and in chorus, without any arguments and deviations. Just where could such colossal collusion have been carried out? After all, they had no chance to communicate with each other during the interrogation period." Several pages further along, a witness who survived will tell us where. Now, it is not for me to tell the reader, but for the reader to tell me just what the notorious riddle of the Moscow trials of the 30s consisted of. At first, people were astounded at the prompt party trial, and then that riddle was transferred to the trials of the party leaders. After all, they didn't put on trial in open court the 2,000 who had been dragged into it, or even 200 or 300, but only 8 people. It is not as hard as all that to direct a chorus of eight. And as for his choices, Krylenko was free to choose from thousands over a period of 2 years. Palchinsky had not been broken, but had been shot, and posthumously named the leader of the prom party, which is what he was called in the testimony, even though no word of his survived. And they had hoped to beat what they wanted out of Krennikov, and Krennikov didn't yield to them either. Therefore, he appeared just once in the record, in a footnote in small type. Krennikov died during the course of his interrogation. The small type you are using is for fools, but we at least know, and we will write it in double-sized letters, tortured to death during interrogation. He, too, was posthumously named a leader of the prom party, but there wasn't one least little fact from him, not one tiny piece of testimony in the general chorus, not one. Because he did not give even one. And then all at once, Ramsin appeared. He was a find. What energy and what a grasp. And he was ready to do anything in order to live. And what talent. He had been arrested only at the end of the summer, just before the trial, really. And he not only managed to enter fully into his role, but it seemed as though he had written the whole play. He had absorbed a whole mountain of interrelated material, and he could serve it up spick and span, any name at all, any fact at all. And sometimes he manifested the languid ornateness of a bigwig scientist. The activity of the prom party was so widespread that even in the course of an 11-day trial there is no opportunity to disclose it in total detail. In other words, go on and look for it, look further. I am firmly convinced that a small anti-Soviet stratum still exists in engineering circles. Go get 'em, grab some more. And how capable he was. He knew that it was a riddle, and that a riddle must be given an artistic explanation. And, unfeeling as a stick of wood, he found then and there within himself the traits of the Russian criminal for whom purification lay in public recantation before all the people. Ramsin has been undeservedly neglected in Russian memories. In my view, he fully deserved to become the prototype of a cynical and dazzling traitor, the Bengal fire of betrayal. He wasn't the only such villain of this epoch, but he was certainly a prominent case. So what it comes down to is that all Krylenko and the GPU had to do was select the right people. But the risk was small. Goods spoiled in interrogation could always be sent off to the grave. And whoever managed to get through both the frying pan and the fire could always be given medical treatment and be fattened up and put on public trial. So then, where is the riddle? How they were worked over? Very simply, do you want to live? And even those who don't care about themselves care about their children or grandchildren. Do you understand that it takes absolutely no effort to have you shot without your ever leaving the courtyards of the GPU? And there was no doubt whatever about that. Whoever hadn't yet learned it would be given a course in being ground down by the Lubyanka. But it is useful both for you and for us to have you act out a certain drama, the text for which you, as specialists, are going to write yourselves, and we, as prosecutors, are going to learn by heart, and we will try to remember the technical terms. Krylenko sometimes made mistakes during the trial. He said freight car axle instead of locomotive axle. It will be unpleasant to perform, and you will feel ashamed, but you just have to suffer through it. After all, it is better to live. And what assurance have we that you won't shoot us afterward? Why should we take vengeance on you? You are excellent specialists, and you have not committed any crimes, and we value you. Look at how many wrecking trials there have been. You'll see that no one who behaved has been shot. Mercy for the defendants who cooperated in one trial was an important prerequisite for the success of the next. And hope was transmitted via this chain right up to Zinoviev and Kamenev themselves. But the understanding is that you have to carry out all our conditions to the very last. The trial must work for the good of socialist society. And the defendants would fulfill all the conditions. Thus they served up all the subtlety of engineers' intellectual opposition as dirty wrecking on a level low enough to be comprehensible to the last illiterate in the country. But they had not yet descended to the level of ground glass in the food of the workers. The prosecutors had not yet thought that one up. A further theme was ideological motivation. Had they begun to wreck? it was the result of a hostile motivation, and now they jointly collaborated in confessing? It was once again the result of ideological motivation, for they had been converted, in prison, by the blazing blast furnace face of the third year of the five-year plan. Although in their last words they begged for their lives, that wasn't the main thing for them. Fedotov, there is no forgiveness for us. The prosecutor is right. The main thing for these strange defendants right at that moment on the threshold of death was to convince the people and the whole world of the infallibility and far-sightedness of the Soviet government. Ramzin, in particular, glorified the revolutionary consciousness of the proletarian masses and their leaders, who had been able to find immeasurably more dependable paths of economic policy than the scientists, and who had calculated the tempos of economic growth rate far more correctly. And then, I had come to understand it was necessary to make a jump ahead, and that it was necessary to make a leap forward. And that is how they were talking here in the Soviet Union, in our own country, in 1930, when Mao Tse-tung was still a stripling. That it was necessary to capture by storm, etc., etc. And Larachev declared, the Soviet Union is invincible against the weakening capitalist world. And Kalinnikov, the dictatorship of the proletariat is an inevitable necessity. And further, the interests of the people and the interests of the Soviet government merge into one purposeful whole. Yes, and in addition, in the countryside, the general line of the party, the destruction of the kulaks, is correct. They had time, while awaiting execution, to deliver themselves of judgments about everything, and the repenting intellectuals even had enough voice for such a prophecy as this. In proportion to the development of society, individual life is going to become more circumscribed. Collective will is the highest form. Thus it was that with 8-horse traction all the goals of the trial were attained. 1. All the shortages in the country, including famine, cold, lack of clothing, chaos, and obvious stupidities, were blamed on the engineer wreckers. 2. The people were terrified by the threat of imminent intervention from abroad and therefore prepared for new sacrifices. 3. Leftist circles in the West were warned of the intrigues of their governments. 4. The solidarity of the engineers was destroyed. All the intelligentsia was given a good scare and left divided within itself. And so that there should be no doubt about it, this purpose of the trial was once more clearly proclaimed by Ramzin. I would like to see that, in consequence of the present trial of the Prompt Party, the dark and shameful past of the entire intelligentsia will be buried once and for all. Larachev joined in. This caste must be destroyed. There is not and there cannot be loyalty among engineers. And Otchkin, too. The intelligentsia is some kind of mush. As the state accuser has said, it has no backbone, and this constitutes unconditional spinelessness. How immeasurably superior is the sensitivity of the proletariat. For some reason, the main thing about the proletariat is always, believe it or not, sensitivity. Always via the nostrils. So now, just why should such diligent collaborators be shot? And that was the way the history of our intelligentsia has been written for decades. From the anathema of 1920, the reader will remember, not the brains of the nation, but shit, and the ally of the black generals, and the hired agent of imperialism, right up to the anathema of 1930. So, should anyone be surprised that the word intelligentsia got established here in Russia as a term of abuse? That is how the public trials were manufactured. Stalin's searching mind had once and for all attained its ideal. Those blunderheads Hitler and Goebbels would come to envy it and rush into their shameful failure with the burning of the Reichstag. The standard had been set, and now it could be retained perennially and performed over again every season, according to the wishes of the chief producer. And in fact, the chief wanted another within 3 months. The rehearsal time was very short, but that was all right. Come and see the show. Only in our theatre. A premiere. M. The case of the All-Union Bureau of the Mensheviks, March the 1st to the 9th, 1931. The case was heard by a special assize of the Supreme Court, the presiding judge in this case, for some reason, being N.M. Schwernick. Otherwise, everyone was in his proper place. Antonov Saratovsky, Krylenko, and his assistant, Roginsky. The producers were sure of themselves, for after all, the subject wasn't technical, but was party material, ordinary stuff. So they brought 14 defendants onto the stage. And it all went off not just smoothly, but brilliantly. I was 12 at the time. For 3 years, I had been attentively reading everything about politics on the enormous pages of Izvestia. I read the stenographic records of these two trials line by line. In the Prompati case, I had already felt in my boyish heart superfluity, falsehood, fabrication. But at least there were spectacular stage sets, universal intervention, the paralysis of all industry, the distribution of ministerial portfolios. In the trial of the Mensheviks, all the same stage sets were brought out, but they were more pallid, and the actors spoke their lines without enthusiasm, and the whole performance was a yawning bore, an inept, tired repetition. Could it be that Stalin felt this, too, through his rhinoceros hide? How else can one explain his calling off the case of the Working Peasants' Party after it had already been prepared, or why there were no more trials for several years? It would be boring to base our interpretations once again on the stenographic record. In any case, I have fresher evidence from one of the principal defendants in this case, Mikhail Petrovich Yakubovich. At the present moment, his petition for rehabilitation, exposing all the dirty work which went on, has filtered through to Samizdat, our saviour, and people are reading it just as it happened. He was refused rehabilitation. After all, the case in which he was tried had entered the golden tables of our history. After all, one cannot take back even one stone, because the entire building might collapse. Thus it is that MPY still has his conviction on his record. However, for his consolation, he has been granted a personal pension for his revolutionary activity. What monstrosities exist in our country. His story offers material proof and explanation of the whole chain of Moscow trials of the 30s. How was the non-existent Union Bureau created? The GPU had been given an assignment. They had been told to prove that the Mensheviks had adroitly wormed their way into and seized many important government jobs for counter-revolutionary purposes. The genuine situation did not jibe with this plan. There were no real Mensheviks in important posts, but then there were no real Mensheviks on trial either. True, they say V.K. Ikov actually was a member of the quiet, do-nothing, illegal Moscow Bureau of the Mensheviks, but they didn't know that at the trial. He was processed in the second echelon and received a mere 8. The GPU had its own design. 2 from the Supreme Council of the Economy, 2 from the People's Commissariat of Trade, 2 from the State Bank, 1 from the Central Union of Consumer Cooperatives, 1 from the State Planning Commission. What a boring and unoriginal plan. Back in 1920, they had ordered in the matter of the Tactical Center that it include 2 from the Union of Rebirth, 2 from the Council of Public Figures, 2 from this and that, etc. Therefore, they picked the individuals who suited them on the basis of their positions, and whether they were Mensheviks or not depended on whether one believed rumors. Some who got caught this way were not Mensheviks at all, but directives had been given to consider them Mensheviks. The genuine political views of those accused did not interest the GPU in the least. Not all the defendants even knew each other, and they raked in Menshevik witnesses, too, wherever they could find them. One was Kuzma A. Gvozdev, a man whose fate was bitter. This was the same Gvozdev who had been chairman of the workers' group in the War Industry Committee, and whom the Tsarist government, in an excess of stupidity, had arrested in 1916, and the February Revolution had made Minister of Labour. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.